Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, nerds? Welcome back to the show. I am finishing up how is fiat money possible today. So if you have not hit part one and part two yet, this is not going to make a whole lot of sense for you. So go back and hit part one and two. This is part three. And should be our final part. I don't see any reason, like with my time block, I should be able to get this done today and out in a single episode. And I'm really excited about what we're going to be covering tomorrow. So lots of stuff to come. But today we are finishing Hans Hermann Hoppe's How is Fiat Money Possible? And the final section is titled From Deposit and Loan Banking to Fractional Reserve Banking. The de-evolution of credit. And we should have some really fun commentary after we conclude this piece. All right. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump right in. From deposit and loan banking to fractional reserve banking. Banks perform two strictly separate tasks, only one of which has been considered so far. On the one hand, they serve as depositing institutions, offering safekeeping and clearing services. They accept deposits of money, commodity money, and issue claims to money, warehouse receipts, or money substitutes, to their depositors, redeemable at par and on demand. For every claim to money issued by them, they hold an equivalent amount of genuine money on hand, ready for redemption. 100% reserve banking. No interest is paid on deposits. Rather, depositors pay a fee to the bank for providing safekeeping and clearing services. Under conditions of free competition, free entry into the banking industry, the deposit fee, which constitutes a bank's revenue and possible source of profit, tends to be a minimum fee, and the profits, or rather the interest returns, earned in banking tend to be the same as in any other non-banking industry. On the other hand, originally entirely separate institutionally from deposit institutions, banks also serve as intermediaries between savers and investors, as loan banks. In this function, they first offer and enter into time contracts with savers. Savers loan money to the bank for a specified, shorter or longer, period of time in exchange for the bank's contractual obligation of future repayment plus some additional interest return. From the point of view of savers, they exchange present money for a promise of future money, the interest return constituting their reward for performing the function of waiting. Having thus acquired temporary ownership of savings from savers, the bank then reloans the same money to investors, including itself, in exchange for the latter's obligation of future repayment and interest. The interest differential, the difference between the interest paid to savers and that charged to borrowers, represents the price for intermediating between savers and investors and constitutes the loan bank's income. As for deposit banking and deposit fees, under competitive conditions, the costs of intermediation also tend to be minimum costs, and the profits from loan banking likewise tend to be the same as those that can be earned elsewhere. Neither deposit banking nor loan banking, as characterized here, involve an increase in the money supply or a unilateral income or wealth redistribution. For every newly issued deposit note, an equivalent amount of money is taken out of circulation. Only the form of the money changes, not its quantity. And in the course of loan banking, the same sum of money simply changes hands repeatedly. All exchanges between depositors and depositing institutions as well as between savers, the intermediating bank, and investors, are mutually advantageous. In contrast, fractional reserve banking involves a deliberate confusion between the deposit and the loan function. It implies an increase in the money supply, and it leads to a unilateral income redistribution in the bank's favor, as well as to economic inefficiencies in the form of the boom-bust business cycle. The confusion of both banking functions comes to light in the fact that under fractional reserve banking, either depositors are being paid interest rather than having to pay a fee, and or savers are granted the right of instant withdrawal rather than having to wait with their request for redemption until a specified future date. Technically, the possibility of a bank's engaging in such practices arises out of the fact that the holders of demand deposits, claims to money redeemable on demand, instantly and at par, typically do not exercise their right simultaneously, such that all of them approach the bank with the request for redemption at the same time. Accordingly, a deposit bank will typically hold an amount of reserves, of money proper, in excess of actual daily withdrawals. It becomes thus feasible for the bank to loan these, quote, excess reserves to borrowers, thus earning the bank an interest return, which the bank then may partially pass on to its depositors in the form of interest-paying deposit accounts. Proponents of fractional reserve banking usually claim that this practice of holding less than 100% reserves represents merely an innocuous money economizing, and they are fond of pointing out that not only the bank, but depositors receiving interest and savers receiving instant withdrawal rights profit from the practice as well. In fact, fractional reserve banking suffers from two interrelated fatal flaws and is anything but innocuous and all-around beneficial. First off, it should be noted that anything less than 100% reserve deposit banking involves what one might call a legal impossibility. For in employing its excess reserves for the granting of credit, the bank actually transfers temporary ownership of them to some borrower, while the depositors, entitled as they are to instant redemption, retain their ownership over the same funds. But it's impossible that for some time depositor and borrower are entitled to exclusive control over the same resources. Two individuals cannot be the exclusive owner of one and the same thing at the same time. Accordingly, any bank pretending otherwise, in assuming demand liabilities in excess of actual reserves, must be considered as acting fraudulently. Its contractual obligations cannot be fulfilled. For the outset, the bank must be regarded as inherently bankrupt, as revealed by the fact that it could not, contrary to its own presumption, withstand a possible bank run. Second, in lending its excess reserves to borrowers, the bank increases the money supply. Regardless whether the borrowers receive these reserves in the form of money proper or in that of demand deposits, checking accounts. If the loan takes the form of genuine money, then the amount of money proper in circulation is increased without withdrawing an equivalent amount of money substitutes from circulation. And if it takes the form of a checking account, then the amount of money substitutes is increased without taking a corresponding amount of genuine money out of circulation. In either case, there will be more money in existence now than before, leading to a reduction in the purchasing power of money, inflation, and in its course, to a systematic redistribution of real income in favor of the bank and its borrower clients, and at the expense of the non-bank public and all other bank clients. The bank receives additional interest income while it makes no additional contribution whatsoever to the real wealth of the non-bank public, as would be the case if the interest return were the result of reduced bank spending, in other words, savings, and the borrowers acquire real non-monetary assets with their funds, thereby reducing the real wealth of the rest of the public by the same amount. Moreover, Insofar as the bank does not simply spend the excess reserves on its own consumption, but instead loans them out against interest charges, invariably a business cycle is set in motion. The quantity of credit offered is larger than before. As a consequence, the price of credit, the interest charge for loans, will fall below what it otherwise would have been. At a lower price, more credit is taken. Since money cannot breed more money, the borrowers, in order to be able to earn an interest return and a pure profit on top of it, will have to convert their borrowed funds into investments. In other words, they will have to purchase or rent factors of production, land, labor, and possibly capital goods, produced factors of production, capable of producing a future output of goods whose value or price exceeds that of the input. Accordingly, with an expanded volume of credit, more presently available resources will be bound up in the production of future goods instead of being used for present consumption than otherwise would have been. And in order to complete all investment projects now underway, more time will be needed than the required to complete only those that would have been begun without the credit expansion. All the future goods which would have been created without the expansion, plus those that are newly added on account of the credit expansion, must be produced. However, in distinct contrast to the situation where the interest rate falls due to a fall in the rate of time preference, in other words, the degree to which present goods are preferred over future goods, and hence where the public has in fact saved more so as to make a larger fund of present goods available to investors in exchange for their promise of a return of future goods, no such change in time preference and savings has taken place in the case under consideration. The public has not saved more, and accordingly, the additional amount of credit granted by the bank does not represent commodity credit, or credit covered by non-money goods which the public has abstained from consuming, but it is fiduciary or circulating credit, credit that has been literally created out of thin air without any corresponding sacrifice in the form of non-consumed, non-money goods on the part of the creditor. Had the additional credit been commodity credit, an expanded volume of investment activities would have been warranted. There would have been a sufficiently large supply of present goods that could be devoted to the production of future goods, such that all, the old as well as the newly begun, investment projects could be successfully completed, and a higher level of future consumption attained. If the credit expansion is due to the granting of circulation credit, however, the ensuing volume of investment must actually prove overambitious. Misled by a lower interest rate, investors act as if savings had increased. They withdraw more of the presently available resources for investment projects to be converted into future capital goods than is warranted in light of actual savings. Consequently, capital goods prices will increase initially relative to consumers' good prices. But once the public's underlying time preference rate begins to reassert itself, a systematic shortage of consumer goods will arise. Accordingly, the interest rate will adjust upward, and it is now consumer goods prices which rise relative to capital goods prices, requiring the liquidation of part of the investment as unsustainable malinvestment. The earlier boom will turn to bust, reducing the future standard of living below the level that otherwise could have been reached. Among recent proponents of fractional reserve banking, the cases of Lawrence White and George Selgin deserve a few critical comments, if for no other reason than that both are critics of Friedmanite monetarism, and they hark back instead to the tradition of Austrian and, in particular, Misesian monetary theory. Their monetary ideal is a universal commodity money such as an international gold standard, and based on this, a system of competitive banking which they claim would and should be permitted to do so for reasons of economic efficiency as well as justice, engage in fractional reserve banking, and the granting of fiduciary credit. As to the question of justice, White and Selgin offer but one argument destined to show the allegedly non-fraudulent character of fractional reserves, that outlawing such a practice would involve a violation of the principle of freedom of contract by preventing, quote, banks and their customers from making whatever sorts of contractual arrangements are mutually agreeable, end quote. Yet this is surely a silly argument. First off, as a matter of historical fact, fractional reserve banks never informed their depositors that some or all of their deposits would actually be loaned out, and hence could not possibly be ready for redemption at any time. Even if the bank were to pay interest on deposit accounts, and hence it should have been clear that the bank must loan out deposits, this does not imply that any of the depositors actually understand this fact. Indeed, it's safe to say that few, if any, do, even among those who are not economic literates. Nor did fractional reserve banks inform their borrowers that some or all of the credit granted to them had been created out of thin air and was subject to be recalled at any time. How then can their practice be called anything but fraud and embezzlement? Second, and more decisive, to believe that fractional reserve banking should be regarded as falling under and protected by the principle of freedom of contract involves a complete misunderstanding of the very meaning of this principle. Freedom of contract does not imply that every mutually advantageous contract should be permitted. Clearly, if A and B contractually agree to rob C, this would not be in accordance with the principle. Freedom of contract means instead that A and B should be allowed to make any contract whatsoever regarding their own properties. Yet fractional reserve banking involves the making of contracts regarding the property of third parties. Whenever the bank loans its, quote, excess reserves to a borrower, such a bilateral contract affects the property of third parties in a threefold way. First, by thereby increasing the money supply, the purchasing power of all other money owners is reduced. Second, all depositors are harmed because the likelihood of their successfully recovering their own possessions is lowered. And third, all other borrowers of commodity credit, are harmed because the injection of fiduciary credit impairs the safety of the entire credit structure and increases the risk of a business failure for every investor of commodity credit. All right, time for a drink. I'm getting worn out. We will hit our sponsor and be right back. In order to overcome these objections to the claim that fractional reserve banking accords with the principle of freedom of contract, White and Selgin then, as their last line of defense, withdraw to the position that banks may attach an option clause to their notes, informing depositors that the bank may at any time suspend or defer redemption, and letting borrowers know that their loans may be instantly recalled. While such a practice would indeed dispose of the charge of fraud, it is subject to another fundamental criticism, for such notes would no longer be money, but a peculiar form of lottery tickets. It is the function of money to serve as the most easily resaleable and most widely acceptable good, so as to prepare its owner for instant purchases of directly or indirectly serviceable consumer or producer goods at not yet known future dates. Hence, whatever may serve as money, so as to be instantly resaleable at any future point in time, it must be something that bestows an absolute and unconditional property right on its owner. In sharp contrast, the owner of a note to which an option clause is attached does not possess an unconditional property title. Rather, similar to the holder of a, quote, fractional reserve parking ticket, where more tickets are sold than there are parking places on hand and lots are allocated according to a first-come, first-served rule, he is merely entitled to participate in the drawing of certain prizes consisting of ownership or time rental services to specified goods according to specified rules. But as drawing rights, instead of unconditional ownership titles, they only possess temporally conditional value. In other words, until the drawings, and become worthless as soon as the prizes have been allocated to the ticket holders. Thus, they would be uniquely unsuited to serve as a medium of exchange. In regards to the second contention, that fractional reserve banking is economically efficient, it is noteworthy to point out that White, although he is undoubtedly familiar with the Austrian Misesian claim that any injection of fiduciary credit must result in a boom-bust cycle, nowhere even mentions the problem of business cycles. Only Selgin addresses this problem in his attempt to show that fractional reserve banking does not cause business cycles. However, Selgin then falls headlong into the fundamental Keynesian error of confusing the demand for money, determined by the utility of money, and savings, determined by time preference. According to Selgin, quote, to hold inside money is to engage in voluntary saving, and accordingly, an increase in the demand for money warrants an increase in bank loans and investments. For whenever a bank expands its liabilities in the process of making new loans and investments, it is the holders of the liabilities who are the ultimate lenders of credit, and what they lend are the real resources they could acquire if, instead of holding money, they spent it, end quote. And based on this view of the holding of money as representing saving and an increased demand for money as being the same thing as increased saving, then Selgin goes on to criticize Mises' claim that any issuance of fiduciary media in lowering the interest rate below its natural level must cause a business cycle as, quote, confused. Quote, no ill consequences result from the issue of fiduciary media in response to a greater demand for balances of inside money, end quote. Yet the confusion is all Selgin's. First off, it is plainly false to say that the holding of money, i.e. the act of not spending it, is equivalent to saving. One might as well say, and this would be equally wrong, that the not spending of money is equivalent to not saving. In fact, saving is not consuming, and the demand for money has nothing to do with saving or not saving. The demand for money is the unwillingness to buy or rent non-money goods. These include consumer goods or present goods and capital goods or future goods. Not spending money is to purchase neither consumer goods nor investment goods. Contrary to Selgin, then, matters are as follows. Individuals may employ their monetary assets in one of three ways. They can spend them on consumer goods, they can spend them on investment, or they can keep them in the form of cash. There are no other alternatives. While a person must at all times make decisions regarding three margins at once, invariably the outcome is determined by two distinct and praxeologically unrelated factors. The consumption investment proportion, i.e., the decision of how much of one's money to spend on consumption and how much on investment, is determined by a person's time preference. In other words, the degree to which he prefers present consumption over future consumption. On the other hand, the source of his demand for cash is the utility attached to money, i.e., the personal satisfaction derived from money in allowing him immediate purchases of directly or indirectly serviceable consumer or producer goods at uncertain future dates. Accordingly, if the demand for money increases while the social stock of money is given, this additional demand can only be satisfied by bidding down the money prices of non-money goods. The purchasing power of money will increase. The real value of individual cash balances will be raised, and at a higher purchasing power per unit money, the demand for and the supply of money will once again be equilibrated. The relative price of money versus non-money will have changed. But unless time preference is assumed to have changed at the same time, real consumption and real investment will remain the same as before. The additional money demand is satisfied by reducing nominal consumption and investment spending in accordance with the same pre-existing consumption investment proportion, driving the money prices of both consumer as well as producer goods, down, and leaving real consumption and investment at precisely their old levels. If time preference is assumed to change concomitantly with an increased demand for money, however, then everything is possible. Indeed, if spending were reduced exclusively on investment goods, an increased demand for money could even go hand in hand with an increase in the rate of interest rate and reduced saving and investment. Yet this or the equally possible opposite outcome would not be due to a change in the demand for money, but exclusively to a change, rise or fall, in the time preference schedule. In any case, if the banking system were to follow Selgin's advice and accommodate an increased demand for cash by issuing fiduciary credit, the social rate of time preference would be falsified. Excessive investment would result, and a boom-bust cycle would be set in motion, rendering the practice of fractional reserve banking fraudulent as well as economically inefficient. White's and Selgin's proposal of a commodity money-based system of competitive fractional reserve banking, of partial fiat money, is neither just, and hence the term free banking is inappropriate, nor does it produce economic stability. It is no fundamental improvement as compared to the monetarist reality of monopolistically issued pure fiat currencies. Indeed, in one respect, Friedman's pure fiat money proposal contains a more realistic and correct analysis than White's and Selgin's, because Friedman recognizes that, quote, what used to be called the inherent instability of fractional reserve banking, end quote. And he understands that this inherent instability of competitive fractional reserve banking will sooner or later collapse in a liquidity crisis and then lead to his favored regime, a governmentally provided pure fiat currency anyway. Only a system of universal commodity money, gold, competitive banks, and 100% reserve deposit banking with a strict functional separation of loan and deposit banking is in accordance with justice, can assure economic stability, and represents a genuine answer to the current monetarist fiasco. And that's it. We have completed Hans Hermann Hoppe's How is Fiat Money Possible? So I got a good chunk of notes on this section. I know particularly those last two pages were probably really, really hard to follow. I tried to emphasize, but I was having a hard time following it, and I've read it before. So so I'm going to hit that in just a minute, but there's a couple other things I want to go over. So in the breaking down of kind of what was deposit banking and then loan banking that were completely separate institutions before our current monetary system was put in place, you realize very quickly that deposits were never meant to be loaned out, because in a sound money system, it's impossible to withdraw the money if it's not actually there. So that's why that's why savings accounts were explicit, like very different accounts. That's why they had strict time period restrictions, strict restrictions on on those funds specifically, because the capital has been loaned out based on specific time periods. So you see immediately the risks involved in loaning that money out to find the right interest rate, like as a banking institution to not loan with too low of an interest rate, because then you won't incentivize, you won't be able to charge a higher one or pay a higher one to savers to get them to actually quote unquote lock up their money. So you can't charge too low to the debtors, and you're ensuring that you don't loan out to people who cannot repay, because then the bank is on the hook and they're trying to, you know, confiscate the actual goods from the guy who took out the loan and couldn't pay it, to make sure that they can actually give the money back to the people who have money locked up as savings, because they've given the money away. Like, the money's no longer there. So they have to sell assets somewhere, whether it's the person who borrowed or their own assets, in order to pay back. So this makes sure that the interest rate is neither too high to prevent a good borrower from taking out a loan, but also not too low to make sure that the bank, the institution that's like managing all of this, has no profits or a limit on the interest that can be paid to savers, or no too low limit on what they would pay to savers, because otherwise savers aren't going to save with them if their competitors are doing a better job at this. So you see how quickly and how tight the margins would be in this market, like if it were actually a free market. Banks would not be these massive multi-trillion dollar institutions unless they were incredibly good at, like they would have to be literally like gold medalist times a thousand. They'd have to be practically omnipotent to be able to loan out all this money and knowingly only make incredibly valuable investments. They'd have to basically rule out the possibility of ever making a bad loan to anyone. So our financial institutions would look absolutely nothing like what they look like today. They would be tightly run money managers trying to make a small gap, and basically begging for money from consumers to save it so that they actually had money to loan out to people. And stupid loans, subprime mortgages, and all that crap would never, ever have existed. All that load of crap and the hundreds of trillions in liabilities that these banks have built up now would not even remotely be possible. Those companies would go out of business when they were doing this to the tune of millions of dollars, not trillions. It would be so stupidly unsustainable. It would have the longest, biggest imbalance that you would have been able to pull off is Mt. Gox. 6 months, everybody's furious with them. People can't withdraw. Like that's sound money. That's fractional reserve banking in a sound money system. Mt. Gox. And it's a disaster, and a lot of people lost money, but it's only because everybody just blindly trusted them. It's taking the old habits of fractional reserve and then shoving it into a market of sound money. People just didn't know what the heck they were doing. Like habits have to change. Concepts of what is real money and what is not have to change. The fact that we've just been assuming everyone has been honest for like 100 years as credit has just been issued just blindly, causing all these boom bust cycles. That we've just assumed that, you know, this is just the way things are, and if I put money in a financial institution, I'm just always going to be able to get it back. All of those habits and ideas that level of understanding has to change. It is incompatible with a sound money system or a sound money economy. So I have like a savings account today. I'm like looking at the ridiculousness that is our current system. I had a few thousand dollars in it for some time before. I guess I technically still just had a few thousand dollars in it. Just to have dollars on hand. I don't have any restrictions on, you know, whether or not I can move money in and out of it. But literally on a couple thousand dollars in an economy where saved capital is almost non-existent. Like there is no savings anywhere, and there are trillions of dollars being loaned out. So we're literally looking at a suggestion where like who knows what the ratio is of like actual capital, but my $2,000 could be backing like $100,000, $200,000 of loans. When you compare the actual size of the credit expansion versus the amount of real savings and value that it is loaned against. There's no telling how far that tiny amount of savings has been stretched. I earned straight up like 13 cents in interest payments. Like that's not an interest rate. That's not how could you ever, if you are loaned beyond belief and you're paying people 13 cent to have a savings account, how could you ever think that you were going to solve that imbalance? And how stupid could we be to think that the solution to this is to loan more money? Yet they're loaning so much money, and the banks are loaning it out at like huge interest rates. Like, credit card companies are loaning it at 20%, 27% interest. Like, that's not exactly a small margin, and they don't seem to care at all whether or not anybody is saving money. And they've loaned out everybody's deposits, and then some, by many orders of magnitude, and they don't care. The government's going to pick up the check. Like, they've got a government guarantee that if they screw over all of their depositors and somehow the bank goes under, they already know the bank is probably going to get bailed out again. They've written most of the laws. They just hire, you know, political spokesmen to sell their bills to the Congress. There is no position that's quite as abusive and powerful as the legal right of fractional reserve. And to know that if they screw over their customers, the government's just going to take care of it. The government's just going to do the same thing they did that got them into trouble. The institution has loaned themselves or has built up liabilities that cannot maintain the deposit, the value of the deposits. And then they go under for this. The government bails them out and then pays back all the depositors up to, you know, $100,000, the FDIC. And how does the government pay for it? The government goes into debt. The government takes out a liability from our central bank to do the exact same thing that the private bank has done to screw themselves over. And so, like, you're on, like, the depositors are paying the bill like three times over. They're paying, they're not able to curb the idiotic policies. They are having to pay for the bailout when things go awry, and they are having the value of their money taken from them, both in the process of the bank loaning out against their way more against the value of their deposits, and in the government then taking out a loan and pumping new issuance into the economy in order to pay back the original depositors. Like, so, like, just so screwed in so many different ways. So when you're thinking about this in terms of deposit banking, like safeguarding, as that, like, that's the role of the bank, or at least deposit banks, you have to remember that all money is the redemption notes, or are they behave as redemption notes for real resources in the real world. So when the bank is loaning out money it doesn't have, or loaning out someone else's money and then telling them that it's still there and they can still spend it, so they've never removed it from the depositor's account, they're granting the exclusive right over past created value, over the resources that have been built and created into the world. The past value, labor, time, and expertise of the depositors to multiple people at once. They're saying that the depositor has the exclusive right to it, and then secretly going and telling someone else that they have the exclusive right to it because they've loaned it out. So those resources, the actual resources, the either the time, the human time it took to create that value, or the products that were used, or the products that were inevitably created, the actual resource cannot be exclusively owned and controlled by two separate people at once. Like, if you have two people living in two completely different cities going to two completely different jobs, those two people cannot drive the same car to their job at the same time. And the car analogy equivalent of what the bank is doing is, like, let's say the bank is just a big garage, a safekeeping for cars, that they are holding your car in the garage, and without telling you, they give it to somebody else and let them drive it to work. Then when you go to get your car out of the bank, or out of the safekeeping bank garage in the morning to go to work, they instead give you a piece of paper that they call a car certificate, which I guess you're just going to hold up in the air while you sprint down the highway to work. Or, of course, they just loan you the next guy's car. And then that keeps happening down the line as everybody needs their car and finds out that they're having to borrow a different car. And then we run out of cars. Just like he talked about, it's a weird lottery where you have drawing rights where they've sold, you know, 1,000 tickets to for a car to drive to work, and there's only 900 cars. And then at the end of the day, 100 people didn't make it work, and You know, it's not the bank's fault. It's just economic efficiency. Like, what? I mean, imagine you go to, you know, you put your sandwich in the fridge at lunch and somebody else eats it and then leaves a sandwich certificate. Like you can't, you can't create resources out of nothing. And selling certificates that, notes that cannot be redeemed for actual goods is useless, is absolutely pointless, and it's fraudulent. It's fraudulent. I mean, he kind of makes it pretty clear, but this simple fact of the matter, it's fraud. All right, so we can actually use this car analogy. I was originally trying to come up with a housing market analogy, but even in writing this whole thing out, because the part where he talks about how the credit expansion leads to a business cycle is also something that I think probably is a little bit hard to follow. And so I tried to come up with one that has to do with the housing market, but I think I can actually do it probably a little bit easier with the car analogy. So let's take the car analogy instead. Let's say the bank is, for simple math, let's say the bank has 1,000 cars, that they've got 1,000 little garages with cars, and they're keeping everybody's quote-unquote car safe. But they've also loaned out 1,000 cars. So there are actually no cars in the garage, even though the people who put the cars in the garage have their own car certificate, and then they have loaned out 1,000 car certificates to other people. So now there are 2,000 people who may or may not need the cars, and there are only 1,000 cars. So to make this work, we actually have to assume that there are no other means of travel. This is the entire economy, is 2,000 people who need to get places, and only 1,000 cars, and there's no other way to get there. Because you can only do this with like a closed loop of an economy. So what happens? These 2,000 people think that they're all going to be able to go on trips. And when we're talking about a boom-bust cycle, we're talking about the investment phase. We're talking about people who plan for long-term projects where the resources are not available to fulfill those projects. So the boom cycle has the market scheduling for 2,000 road trips that we're going to go to. You know, everybody's planning on going on some vacation. Somebody's going to go to the beach. Another person's going to drive a trip across the country, and they're all booking hotels. They're all planning on, you know, stocking up on food, and they're buying tickets to events that they're going to go to, and everybody's excited. It looks amazing. They're selling twice as many concert tickets as they thought they were going to. They're booking twice as many cottages on the beach as they thought they were going to. So all these prices are being bid up. The ticket prices are being bumped up because seats are filling faster than they expected. It looks like there's so much activity going on, and everybody's planning on taking their car to these road trips. And this is the boom cycle. This is when everybody sees, look at all this future consumption that's going to happen because of all of our saved resources. And everybody is planning to make that consumption happen in a year. Now, that's when people start, as this process happens, people get to their dates and they start withdrawing their cars. They start taking out their car and going on their trips. But these are drawing rights on cars that don't exist. And very quickly we realize only 1,000 people can go on these trips. So eventually, it just happens, people start canceling their tickets. People start trying to resell their tickets online to other people. But all the people who have cars have already bought the tickets. So the tickets go from $200 for the concert to $20 for the concert, because now there's 1,000 tickets being sold and nobody buying them. And suddenly people are canceling their cottage leases and their rentals, and they're canceling their dinner plans and their hotel reservations. All of these things that got just exploded during the boom period, now half of them have to be canceled because there were only half the cars available. This is the equivalent of what the bank is doing with money. It's just completely obscured because it's not just the number of cars. It's not just the number of houses. It's the amount of every single resource and alternative that exists in the economy. It's a huge, widespread, convoluted mess that's so hard to see, but like at a fundamental level, this is what's occurring. And we saw it exactly in the housing boom and bust, and now we're seeing it in the financial, like we've gone all the way to just financial derivatives being the boom bust cycle. It's just the stock market and in fake monetary instruments that it's happening because we've run our course in anything meaningful. But you saw that exact same thing. So many housing projects were created based on these people who were going to be buying them. The prices got bid up to ridiculous levels. So many people who couldn't afford a house and were never going to be able to earn the amount and were just expecting to buy it on debt and then flip it in 2 years because the housing price was going to go up and they were going to make a profit. All of this stuff just kept exploding and compounding and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then suddenly we realized we don't have enough resources to build all these houses. Nobody made the wood. The bricks aren't there. Suddenly there's a shortage of everything needed to keep this thing running. And it's like, how? How did we start 1,000 projects when we only had 500 projects worth of resources and bid up the goods all the way across the economy, forcing the 1,000 people, our example with the cars, you forced the people who actually had the cars to pay higher tickets or higher prices for their tickets, to pay higher rental prices for their cottages. They had to pay higher hotel rates because the hotel rooms were filling up, even though nobody was actually competing, no real resources were competing in the economy. They were competing with people who were borrowing their money. The people who earned had their money borrowed away from them, had their resources taken to bid up the prices for the stuff they were going to have to purchase. It's just absolutely insane. But that's how the business cycle works. It's just over the entire economy and over so many different resources and industries and different facets of the economy that it's invisible. And people act like we just don't know why this is happening. It doesn't make any sense, and everybody's confused and baffled by the whole thing, when it's just the manipulation of interest rates. It's just loaning money that doesn't exist. It all has an incredibly simple cause. It just goes through so many steps in the process of unfolding that it looks convoluted and messy and confused. And so you can just come up with these stupid theories that have nothing to do with what actually happened, and you can point to, well, this institution had a ton of loans that were dumb, and this institution had this, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, how did you create the environment where people are making idiotic loans? How are they making $100 million loans when they have $50 million in the accounts? Like there's a much more fundamental story happening. That's kind of the whole, hopefully that analogy makes it a little bit clearer to exactly what is happening with the fractional reserve, like kind of the business cycle. All right, and then lastly, to hit the Selgin, like those last two pages on like Selgin's demand for money is savings, because that one was a little bit hard to follow. All right, so Selgin's argument, as I understand it, is that an increase in the demand for money should be met with an increased supply, because an increase in the demand or the continual withholding of money means there's additional savings. It's suggesting that the increased fiduciary credit, the expansion of the credit, is there to balance out the difference in demand. The bank should do this with the supply of credit rather than the price of the money adjusting to find equilibrium, which is what every other good and market does. It's the price of the good that adjusts to find the equilibrium between the amount and its demand. So in his estimation, the demand for money means there's more savings. But Hoppe's rebuttal is in clarifying that the higher demand for money does not mean that there is more savings. It could be consistent. The act of holding money is simply the continuous choice to not spend it on something. And remember, money is its own good. You have three options with money, essentially. You can either spend it for immediate consumption goods. You could spend it on investment in future consumption, which is a difference between time preference. Those are the two different things of time preferences. Or you can just hold it in cash, which time preference is what controls the balance between purchasing direct consumer goods versus producer goods and investments. Like if you want a sandwich immediately, you buy one right now. If you want to have 1,000 sandwiches later, and you're okay with not having any sandwiches right now, you buy a building, you build a kitchen, supplies, and hire workers, and then you open a restaurant, and you go there to eat for free, and you just have infinite sandwiches. But if you're uncertain about what you want to do in the future, and you don't know when you're going to do it, or when you make the decision, and you're unsure about the future risks versus today's risks, then you hold the most saleable good, money. You're holding that good to make decisions about your decision about whether when you do spend it, whether it's on a low time preference or high time preference good, is no different. Or it may be completely unchanged. So when the demand for money increases, because money's held out of circulation, the balance is met by the increase of the money's purchasing power, because the number of goods available per unit of money has been increased. So the prices of all non-money goods fall in relation to it. But that doesn't mean that time preferences of consumption have altered. You could still have the exact same immediate consumption versus investment and producer consumption going on. The allocation for both could be completely unchanged. The additional demand for a money good instead of a consumption good is based on the price of the money. So Selgin's claim is essentially putting the cart before the horse by saying that we should issue newly created money as a loan, assuming that time preference has changed, which is going to lead to excessive investments, because we don't know what has happened with time preference. And this ultimately creates a boom and bust cycle. I still think kind of this is a little bit more convoluted way of explaining it. And the cars and garage scenario is a much more easily followed example, but it's essentially saying the same thing, that the expanded volume of credit, expanding credit takes goods that may have been used or that otherwise would have been used for consumption right now and reallocates them for future consumption, even if the consumption patterns have not changed. So a market, the interest rate is what balances time preference, and the purchasing power of money is balancing the amount of goods per unit of money. So if a market is not balanced by those two things, if the credit market is not balanced by that, then it's completely unsustainable. It's specifically in the change of the purchasing power that balance is kept, rather than the issuance of new credit, which rejects the act of money trying to balance. It rejects the actual balancing act. Like if the purchasing power of money does not increase, then the new credit actually acts to reverse that balancing, while at the same time screwing up the time preference, which we don't know, we have no idea whether it's changed. So we are now going to push people into future consumption and investment, which actually screws up the indicator of the time preference, the interest rate. It pushes the interest rate down, even though it may have needed to go up or not changed at all. So this is actually sort of, it kind of shares a principle in line with the fallacy of Friedman that's discussed in a footnote it's on page 18. I didn't actually go over it, but the footnote is talking about his earlier theories that were covered towards the end of yesterday's episode, based on the idea that to get 3 to 5% like economic growth, you actually had to match the growth of the money supply. If the money supply didn't grow, that you couldn't get the economic growth. But Friedman actually later, in the footnote, it says the Friedman actually later admitted that this wasn't the case when he basically rejected the 3-5% theory, and quote, it was a quote, recognition of the old Humean insight that any supply of money is equally optimal, or in Friedman's own words, that money's usefulness to the community as a whole does not depend on how much money there is. And we actually see that much clearer in the introduction of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is a solely monetary good. So Ripple, just because Ripple has, what is it, hundreds of billions of tokens, does not mean it's a more suitable money. It's nonsense. There could only be one Bitcoin on the entire network. But as long as it retains all of its other properties of, you know, divisibility, verifiability, fungibility, et cetera, there would be virtually no difference in its function. There could be a billion Bitcoin, there could be 21 million, there could be 1,000, there could be just one. The resulting economic activity and pricing structure would be unaffected if all of the other characteristics were identical. So it's in that the supply of money has nothing to do with the growth, or the expansion of the money supply should not have anything to do with the growth of the economy. In fact, it's a counter, a counter indicator thing. It's shifting, it's forcing shifts in the time preference that shouldn't be there. It's just explicitly pushing things out of balance rather than letting the natural balances take place. So, hopefully that was a little bit more. A little easier to follow. This rant or follow-up turned into a really, really long one. So I hope you guys stuck with me for that. We are going to do some really fun stuff for the remainder of the week. I have got a ton of crap lined up to read. So many things to cover now, particularly with doing two of these long ones. I keep having things fill up my lists and don't get to get to them very quickly. So do not forget to subscribe to the show. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. And of course, this is the Crypto Economy podcast. If you're first listening here, you should have listened to part one and part two, but you know, maybe somebody just jumped in here. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. And do not forget to check out Mises.org for the absolutely phenomenal body of work up there. There is no place that I have used on the internet for like Austrian theory and understanding money that honestly could even compare. I have read so much stuff up there. In fact, one of my original ideas for a podcast was to try to bring back Mises Daily. I just wanted to read economics every day. Do not forget to check them out. They are a godsend in the Austrian economic space. There is nobody like them. So that is Mises.org. How is fiat money possible? We have completed it, by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode. Don't miss it. I'll catch you all back here. Until then, take it easy, guys.